Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by SWCA. Since our founding in Flagstaff in 1981, SWCA Environmental Consultants has helped public and private clients overcome environmental challenges and move their projects forward. As we celebrate our 40th year in business, our 100% employee-owned firm offers comprehensive environmental planning, regulatory compliance, and natural and cultural resources management services. We are the problem solvers, the scientists, the planners, the technical specialists, and the creative thinkers. Thank you, SWCA, for your support of Big Adventures. Our friend Lynn is also supporting us this week. Thank you, Lynn, and we hope to see you on the river.
You know, this community has a lot of amazing people, as I've often said, and this is one of them, Gary Bolton. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thanks, Brian.
Gary has been all over the world, and he's done so much stuff, but he's also been a boatman in Grand Canyon for a really long time, and we've known each other for how long? I mean, a long time.
Early 70s?
Way back.
Yeah.
And he looks great. He looks better than most 69-year-olds, I'll say that. But the neat thing about your story, Gary, to me, is it's kind of mixed with a lot of different things. Your scientific-type mind and adventure mind and guiding mind and Grand Canyon. So we got a lot to talk about.
All right.
You guys, this is Big Adventures with Brian Durker and Gary Bolton this morning, and thanks for sitting in. Particularly glad to have you. I mean, this is... A great chance for us to catch up. You know, we see each other here and there, but we don't get a chance to really sit down and have quality conversation. You know, I always like to start by asking where you were born and you know, kind of where your childhood, early formative years come into it.
Right. Well, I grew up in Santa Rosa, California.
Ah, yes.
North of San Francisco.
When you were that young, it was probably a lot less populated than central and southern part of the state.
Huh? Oh, yeah, about 30,000 in Santa Rosa.
Oh, is that right?
When I was a kid.
And you were there, you lived there through high school?
That's right, yeah. I was an only child, and but I spent a lot of time outdoors. And so started that real early.
Uh-huh.
And got into high school and got really into science and biology. And
now when you were in like grade school and stuff, did you spend time on the ocean a lot? You must have.
Oh, we would go out there.
You never got into the surfing? And
surfing wasn't big in Northern California, that part.
In the background, you guys, you hear Hazel the cat, and I thought I had her stowed away, but she'll join us. But you spent time on the ocean and probably a lot of time in the hills around Santa Rosa.
Well, time on the coast, not out at sea.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, in the hills, beautiful hills around there. And when I was in high school, I was getting into rock climbing.
Oh, cool.
So going out with a small circle of friends that were a little older and finding local crags to climb on. It was pretty eccentric. People thought we were weirdos 50 years ago.
Yeah, old school.
Rock climbing.
Yeah. And so then you went to, it was your high school years fun? And
yeah.
Did you like high school?
Well, yeah, I had my circle of friends. I wasn't a big socialite, but...
Something doesn't surprise me about that.
But really got into the outdoors. Learned a lot of outdoor skills in Boy Scouts, actually, you know, early on.
Yeah, I was a Boy Scout, too. Those are great, great times in Boy Scouts, till I got thrown out. And then you were probably on the honor roll in high school.
Huh? Oh, yeah, that's true.
You
yeah.
were a good student, weren't you, Gare? And so then where did that take you on an educational basis? Did you go to school in California or did you?
Yeah, I went straight to the University of California in Davis, just west of Sacramento.
Oh, yeah.
Central Valley.
And was that a nice school? You liked the atmosphere there?
A wonderful, a really top-notch university.
And yeah.
I studied science and biology and botany. So studied, got a bachelor's degree in biology and master's degree in botany.
Yeah, and I know botany's taken you all over the world. I know that, and we're going to get to that. What's really neat, too, is I understand in later years it's taken you to, like, historic record of botany. And tell us a little bit about botany right now, because that's kind of where it led you. You've got to...
Yeah, well, I'm thinking back to it late in my bachelor's degree. I'm deciding, am I going to study marine biology or botany? And I thought long and hard about it, and I hugged a tree, and I thought, it's going to be botany.
I knew you were a tree hugger. We won't go into the political ramifications of that, but I'm sure there are some. And so what was, did you have a specialty in that field that really kind of floated your botany boat?
I took about every kind of course in botany that existed, but... ended up focusing on plant ecology.
And what's that all entailed for my visitor?
Just where plants grow and why and how they get along with each other and the animals.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, it's cool. That's what I kind of assumed. Do you have a favorite plant that you've looked at? Or you probably have a whole
bunch of them. I don't like to play favorites with plants.
How about the grasses?
Oh, they're tough.
That's a tough one, isn't it? Dear friend of mine, Mike Yard, really got into the grasses mm-hmm. when he was in school, and it pretty tough, huh?
Yeah.
Pretty, the identification and the small innuendo that goes into identification and all that. And so with that, you started on the river at a pretty young age, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was after my first year at UC Davis. Through a friend, I learned that people in the Sierra Nevada foothills went down these rivers. And they went down these rivers. It was kind of like, you go down a little staircase of white water and through a pool and do that again. And they would do it in rubber boats. And what's more, on the weekend, they would take people on those boats and they'd make money.
So you put all those different pieces together and put yourself in the middle of the boat. Holding the paddle.
Yeah, holding the oars.
Oars. And what was your first river?
The Stanislaus.
Guiding? Stanislaus, cool.
Yeah, and that was 71, guiding on the Stanislaus, and then the American and Tuolumne and Merced Rivers.
Yeah, yeah. And who were you working for? Several companies or Outdoors Unlimited?
Well, Outdoors Unlimited, out of Sacramento. That.
Outdoors Unlimited came in there, one of the last companies to get a permit in Grand Canyon. For the listener, and it's one of the smaller companies. It kind of came in there just after the company I worked for, Grand Canyon Youth Expeditions, and Wilderness World and OU, I think, were the last permits given out.
Yeah.
Something like that. But so you were there before he got his Grand Canyon permits.
Well, I was...
Or around that time.
Yeah, yeah. My first Grand Canyon trip was 73.
Uh-huh.
Rowing a snout rig with two people on it.
Yeah.
With John Seppi.
John Seppi was always my hero when I was a kid.
And Tom Olson and I.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I probably even saw you on that trip. John Seppi was great. I mean, he just run it down through the hole in Crystal, and he did it all. He was a cool dude. What's he doing now, Seppi?
Oh, he lived in Southern California. I think he's still there.
Uh-huh.
And... I saw him once just a few years ago, maybe 10 or so.
That is just a few. And he was doing all right, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this, when you've been in this industry as long as you and I have, it's amazing trying to keep track of all these old boatmen and all the crazy directions everybody's gone, or they're still there like we are.
Yeah.
Or both, and So you worked for OU for years and years and years, and then, but during your off seasons, were you teaching or were you, you got into a lot of different things, but one of those is you got into like international guiding.
Right.
So can talk to us about your progression with your international interests in regards to guiding.
Well, at the end of my master's degree at Davis in 76, I thought, should I go straight on for a PhD or follow my wanderlust and do rivers around the world? And that's what I ended up doing.
And so where how'd you launch that? Now, you were a Sobek guy.
Yeah, I first went over to Ethiopia with Sobek in 76.
Oh, wow, that's early in the game over there, too.
Yeah, we did some, you know, the Omo River was a 25-day trip in those days.
And was it Bart? You were probably with Bart Henderson, who's done a show with us.
That's
here.
Right.
And
Jim Slade,
Jim
John
Slade,
Yost.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
And that
was Rich Bangs a little after that, I guess.
Oh no, he was
there.
He
too,
was in
involved.
The start.
Yeah.
In fact, he came over and we did an exploratory river trip in western Ethiopia on a river system, the Gaba and Birbir and Baro rivers. I don't think it's ever been repeated. It was...
Well, tell us about that. Now, there's an adventure.
Rich Bangs, Jim Slade, John Yost, and I, four of us, with one Avon Adventurer as a paddle boat.
So just a one boat?
A one boat trip. And
with the idea, if you had to carry or portage or go around stuff, that's a good system.
Well, it was a paddle boat, and we were extremely light. We could carry our gear probably in one load and carry the boat in another. One gorge we went through was 200 feet a mile, and it was sieving beneath boulders the size of this house.
Oh, my goodness. And for the listener, again, I mean, we rank rivers quite often by their how many feet they descend in a mile. And so 200 feet is a tremendously steep grade. Like Grand Canyon's, what?
8 feet.
8 or 9 feet a mile. Just for a reference. But anything, especially in a raft that's over 40 feet a mile, is steep and pretty busy water to be navigating and stuff. So 200 feet a mile, that's wild.
Well, we were carrying a bunch of that.
Yeah, you were.
But
we call those waterfalls a lot.
Yeah, and sieves.
And sieves.
Water
that's
going
the terrifying.
Under rocks.
That is truly the terrifying thing, isn't it? But how did it go? Did you have any?
Well, we're here. Yeah, we got through, and there was one really fascinating place on the second, as we went one river into the next, on the second river that was bigger and not as steep, but it flowed into this fault trench that was, you know, picture a smaller scale of Niagara or Zambezi, but going into a trench. And
so a trench, like super contained,
yeah,
sloughs,
like
sort
20
of.
Some feet deep and a little narrower than deep, and it all poured over one the left side in a like 100-yard long curtain, and the right edge was a staircase, so we had to run it, so we scouted, ran that staircase and went through the bottom, with all that big waterfall on the left edge. And whenever I see those guys again, that story comes up.
Well, golly, I can just imagine what a visual imprint that would make, and just what an incredible place. Yeah. So what you're saying is just this place you'd never want to be on the left side, and you're picking your way down the staircase. Huh?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
And how long of a run?
Just 12 days, but a lot happened in 12 days.
Yeah.
We got onto the third river, and the crocodiles were so dense compared to over on the Omo River.
Uh-huh.
There were just crocodiles everywhere. One almost got John Yost. He had his leg over the side, and this croc came rearing up out of the brown, murky water with its jaws open. And Rich Bangs yells, "John, look out!" And we all spin towards our bodies toward the center of the boat, and I'm instinctively slapping the water hard with my paddle. And then John spins his leg in, the crocodile dives under the boat, and we don't see that one again.
Oh, my goodness. Were there hippos there, too?
Oh, yeah, lots of hippos.
Because that's a real dangerous river feature, the hippo.
Yeah, the hippos are actually the animal that caused the most deaths of natives in Africa.
In all of Africa,
and,
yeah.
So Americans have the wrong idea about hippos. And they think they're this kind of goofy, fun-loving animal. And I think it's all because of Fantasia. You know, they see him dancing on their hind legs.
And singing.
And in those pink tutus. They get the wrong impression.
Not so much that way.
Yeah, they can. A bull hippo can be 6,000 to 8,000 pounds, open its jaws up between 4 and 5 feet tall. And,
oh, wow.
And it can have an attitude.
You know, I have just a quick hippo story. I was, there's a place on the Zambezi River, and I was doing a canoe trip down there near Manu Pools. Have you been through that
No.
section? Well, anyway, I had my mother on the canoe with me, and it was a six-day trip down through this national preserve on the Zimbabwe side. So, you know, the hippos are everywhere, and you kind of protect yourself by staying along the shoreline to where they like to be in the deep water, and they're very mobile, and they walk on the river bottom, and they're super territorial. And so you're along the shoreline. Well, we were on the Zimbabwe side, and then Zambia's on the left shore. We're on the right shore cruising along, and we went by this little stream coming in. And just as I was pointing out to my mom in the front of the canoe, look, Mom, a baby hippo. And there was this grasses and the water running down and this little baby hippo. And it was real small hippo. And about the time we slowed the canoe so we could observe this little baby hippo, we're looking over there, and all of a sudden, out of the water, the crocodile lunges out of the water and chomps the little baby hippo and starts rolling around with it and drags it underwater. It was the worst thing.
Wild Kingdom.
It was like the mean old Wild Kingdom. And my mom looked over her shoulder and said, "Thanks a lot for pointing that out, Brian." You know, she had a good sense of humor, but... But yeah, hippopotamus, wow, they're scary. I always thought a couple of them in the Grand Canyon would be kind of fun. You know, kind of keep things a little bit more interesting down there. And so you did the early Sobek stuff. Where else did you go with Sobek? You went all over the place.
Well, a bunch of places, yeah. We went down on the Biobío in Chile, was on the second trip ever down there.
Oh, yeah.
And did trips down there some more. And, did rivers in Mexico and Nepal and Tibet and a bunch of places. But a couple places with Sobek in Papua New Guinea and Borneo.
Tell us about the Borneo trip.
Yeah.
That's a famous expedition. You know.
Well, it's called the Bow River, spelled B-O-H. And it hadn't been run. It had been tried, but... So we were there doing a commercial exploratory, which means it's an exploratory, hasn't been done, and it's commercial. You're taking some people who are paying to go. So you know that can
be a recipe for...
Yes, that's right.
A lot of things.
River was supposed to be... because of some overflight at altitude some years before, it was... estimated to be a class 3-4 river, but it was like 4-5-6. Low volume, except when it flooded and the water came up like 15 feet and we stayed off it because right around the corner was an 80-foot waterfall.
So it would fluctuate real fast depending on just rainfall.
Yes, that's right.
And so the rainfall would go by, the water would drop out quickly as well.
Yeah.
And so you just lay over and wait for it to drop back out?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And there's the 50-foot... It kind of saved you then. It got you off. And did you hike around? But the hiking or the moving around through... Is it dense jungle? Or what was Borneo topography like?
Well, it was dense rainforest. And
yeah.
So a rainforest can be dense at the canopy level and then a little bit more open down at the ground story.
Uh-huh.
And we... when we did that one layover with the high flood and the big falls, the three of us guides took a long walk on a high ridge. And, oh, some places you're really cutting through vegetation. You know, we all have machetes and taking turn lead, cutting the lead.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And we're just up to our necks in biology. And I was hacking away as the lead machete at one point, and Mike Speaks behind me says, "Hold still a minute, and I'll knock this foot-long centipede off your back."
So it was like Jurassic Park sort of place. So.
Yeah.
Really. What other animals does Borneo have as far as...
Oh.
There just must be thick with different critters, huh?
With a dense jungle like that, you don't have as the big animals like African plains or something, but, there are primates in the jungle. And we saw this one huge snake in the river that right ahead of me that, you know, I was rowing a boat, but had a spare paddle and was pulling that out kind of as a defense item in case it came at the boat, like had occurred to some British explorer some years before. But it didn't, kept going.
Was it a python-like thing? Or
hard to say. Yeah, hard to know.
But it was huge.
Yeah.
What other animals were in the water? Did you guys see fish
no,
or any other?
We weren't catching fish. We were mostly running,
focused
running
on,
water
on
and
the task at hand,
lining yeah. and portaging and fixing ropes to get passengers around rapids that we had to line or portage or run empty.
And how did everybody do as far as your clientele, Gary,
well,
on that Borneo trip?
Most did pretty well. Some were more overwhelmed than others.
There's a guide's answer right there.
Well, Tracy Johnston, who ended up writing the book that had a stint on the New York Times bestseller list called Shooting the Bow, spelled B-O-H.
Bow.
And
take a note on that, you guys. That's a read I'm going to have to do, too.
She yeah. came to write... Tracy Johnston.
Tracy Johnston.
Well, Shooting the Bow is the name of the book, so...
Okay.
Anyways, she was coming... Richard Bang sent her along inspired her to join the group to write a magazine article, and it ended up being a bit bigger trip than that, she wrote that book, and...
How long of an expedition was this? It was a lengthy one.
Well, it wasn't you know, many weeks long, but we were in the early gorge, and at one point, the initial gorge, it was thought that we would get through that in about 3 days. Well, it took 10 days. We were a week behind schedule.
After the first section there.
And then we got down onto bigger rivers, and we could travel faster, you know, lower gradient rivers.
Uh-huh.
And then we got to a place where there was this boat, a long and narrow boat, and we just contracted it. And they unloaded all their passengers and cargo and loaded up all our trip and motored us down a couple hundred miles. And we got on another boat that was like a miniature African queen. And traveled day and night. And,
well, how cool.
Yeah, so we came out a week late, and the phones were buzzing in the Sobeck office in Angels Camp.
Yeah, I'll bet. And so how many mile trip do you recall?
I don't recall right off, but one thought just came to me where we'd gotten through the gorge, and we were gotten onto this larger river, and it was a bit more open, and you could see the sky better. And this, we'd gotten into the middle of Borneo. Borneo is a big island. It's the third biggest, 600 miles by 800 miles.
Uh-huh, that is big, yeah.
And it's big for a rugged wilderness. So we'd gotten in there with Mission Aviation Fellowship, you know, guys who, these pilots fly little Cessnas into remote parts of the world to facilitate missionary efforts, for better or worse. And... So we get onto this bigger river, and the sky's more open, and this little plane comes over and flies. We've got three rafts and a known number of people, and this plane comes over and tilts up on its side and flies by. And then it comes by back again, and the plan was that we weren't going to wave if we were okay. And it flies back again, and then it flies a third time, and Tracy Johnston on my boat says, "What's he doing?" And I said, "He's counting."
Yeah, to see how we're doing.
To see how many of us are left.
Still there. That's pretty cool. And so you finish a trip like that. How does that go? Just for the listener, you know, after a long expedition, did you have enough food?
We took a bunch of extra food. And then by the time we got in the bigger river, we were and saw people.
Were there villages along the way?
No, it's remote.
On
the bigger river, there was just a couple, few logging camps and not really a visible logging. But once we got to people, we could start getting food from them. But we took a lot of extra rice and dendeng, which is this, it's this Indonesian jerky.
Huh.
So we were cooking that.
What sort of animal? Was it beef?
Probably beef.
Yeah, but you didn't really know, did you? But like when you finish a trip like that, what sort of logistics did you have lined up, or you're late? I mean, it's just a curiosity on an expedition way of thinking.
Well, we got to the first roadhead, and it was evening, and we contracted these three little vehicles that took us to the town where there was an airport, and everybody starts kind of arranging their flights and getting home.
Uh-huh. So it was kind of
fly by the cuff
there a little bit. Outside of Borneo, tell us about another couple, Sobek. Were you on many of their exploratories? I mean, the Sobek is and they've come up in other shows. They were the first ones to really go and look at the global rivers, and there was a lot of real forward thinking about the potential of commercial river running all over the world. And I think they single-handedly probably affected river running all over the world.
Oh,
because
definitely.
Because it exposed people to this crazy pastime in a lot of different places. And so, but were you on any of the other exploratories they were doing?
I always was coming back to the Grand Canyon for that 5-month summer, and because it was paradise to me. It was the center of my world. And so I missed a lot of exploratory action that was during that time of year.
Yeah, I can identify with that. All my friends were going off and building companies all over the world in Alaska and stuff, and I was kind of the same way. I was in Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
All the time. But Now, you had your own guiding business. It'll tell us a little bit about that. You were more mountain trekking with that.
Well, it wasn't my own business, but I got into trekking in Nepal in 81, and it was leading treks for an Australian company, Australian Himalayan Expeditions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had a lot of adventures, and, you know, I'd be over there on average 4 months a year leading treks, and I'd focus on their longer ones, like 4 weeks on the trail, traveling a lot of country through a lot of ranges, like starting in the far east of Nepal and ending up in the Everest region.
And did you go up to the base camp?
Oh, yeah.
And valleys and villages?
Oh, the high.
The whole
valleys,
Nepal
yeah.
scene, huh? And you did that for years and years.
Oh, over 20 years.
Are you still going over there at all? Or?
I haven't for quite a while. But in the 80s, I would be 5 months guiding in Grand Canyon, and then Australian Himalayan Expeditions would fly me to Nepal to train river guides and work trips, or fly me to Australia. And so I would be 5 months Grand Canyon, 3 months Australia rafting, and then 4 months in Nepal trekking.
That's a good cycle,
and
huh?
That adds up to 12.
And I'll bet that it adds up to some wear and tear, probably. I mean, you don't look like it tore you up too bad, but that's a pretty energetic schedule there to guide.
It was great.
In Nepal, let's talk a little bit about Nepal and these treks. So I'm always curious as far as, like, if you go over there, like, how many clients would you have on these treks?
We would have about 12. That was a...
That's a good number.
That's a good number. I'd have... We'd go up to 15, but you know, there's some outfits like REI, they'll have 25-person treks.
And that kind of takes
that's
away
too
from
big.
It, yeah.
But I would run trips with 10 or 12 often, and if you had 12, the company was happy that they were doing well, and if you had 15, it still wasn't too big. I think the biggest trip I ever led was, let's see, we were going from the far eastern edge of Nepal to the Everest region, 4 weeks on the trail, 17 clients and myself, and the head Sherpa or Sirdar, plus five Sherpas and six kitchen crew, and 50 porters.
Oh, wow. Now, that's an expedition.
Yeah.
That's a big adventure. Now, tell us a little bit about the logistics and the food and on a not so much a big deal like that, but on your normal, like say you got 10, 12 people and you're the guide, would you always have a Sherpa with you?
Oh, definitely. And a Sherpa crew. And so the head Sherpa is called the Sirdar.
Uh-huh.
And they supervise the Sherpas that are supervising the porters, as well as some of them walking with the guests and pitching tents and so on. And then there's a kitchen crew. And so the company is figuring out the food, and I'm not having to do that. So that's why that 12-month guiding cycle worked out. Part of the year, I was a river guide and figuring out the food, and part of the year, I was a trekking guide, and I didn't have to.
Yeah, and that's nice. And for the listener, I mean, running big expeditions, no matter where you are, the food element and the planning that goes into three meals a day and keeping everybody nourished is such a big part of it. And a lot of guides that are on smaller operations, they have to do the pre-packs and the planning, the food planning, the buying. And it's a huge job that a lot of people don't think about when they're not a guide. But that is a big one, isn't it? I mean,
oh yeah,
the guides that are on your trips, would you sometimes have assistant guide? I mean, like if you had 17 people, you're keeping an eye on everybody.
Well, it's with the help of the Sherpas. And the Sherpas are, some of them are walking with the group. So I'm either at the front or the back, and there's only one of me.
Yeah.
There's only one trip leader.
And is there much English with the Sherpas, or do you have to do a little bit? You find a couple guys that do speak English that you can convey?
Nowadays, there's a lot of English spoken amongst the, you know, the trekking staff. But, oh gosh, what is it, 40 years ago, there was little. And so I learned Nepali.
Oh, is that right? Good for you. Can you still speak it?
Well, last night, six of us went out to Delhi Palace, and I'd never been there. And I started, and it's apparently a Nepalese staff, and I started speaking to the head waiter in Nepali, and he just about fell over.
Yeah, he doesn't get a lot of that here in old Arizona. Let's talk a little bit about Australia. I understand you live there now and have for 6-7 years.
Yeah, I've been over there.
Tell us about that. I mean, you'd been working with that company from over there, so you're familiar years ago with Australia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd spent a bunch of time in Australia, and then my wife and son and I did it a sabbatical year in Hobart, Tasmania, 2008. So we were kind of pre-adapted to move over there, and eight years ago now, as she had an attractive offer as a full professor doing research. And we got over there, and I thought, shall I retire? And I thought, no, I'll start my own business as a climbing arborist.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So I'm up in the...
Up in the trees.
Yeah, up in the top of 100-foot spreading eucalyptus trees over people's houses, rigging them down in big swinging pieces.
Yeah, that's an art form. I know a bunch of arborists or tree guys around that are usually climbers.
Yeah,
you know that's a great avenue for a good climber can put together a good system and pull trees down. When you're doing work on a eucalyptus tree, Gary, What are the biggest problems with eucalyptus? What are you up there in the first place for?
Well, it's a diverse genus. There are about 800 species.
Are there really?
Spread around Australia. And so that's one of the fascinating parts about doing this kind of work in the Blue Mountains, the diversity of trees, every size and shape.
Yeah,
some of these native trees have a central trunk. Some of them are very spreading. And that's a real challenge where you have to go way out and then cut a piece off that is caught by the rig rope and shock loads the limb that you're on. And so you need to have a pulley there, but also a pulley across the tree so that it's not levering off this big limb that you're on.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty, you have to back yourself up with a safety element.
Yeah. You rig across the tree if it's a spreading tree.
And do you have a guy that is supporting you on the ground?
Oh, yeah.
Like we've all watched guys take down trees or clean trees and all that, but how big of a crew does it, what do you need?
Depends on the tree.
Yeah.
Sometimes just the homeowner and I take down the tree if he's really keen. Sometimes, or she.
And economically, it probably comes to play.
Yeah, and some big trees, I'll have four or five experienced crew on the ground.
And do you own your own chipper?
No, I hire a friend with a chipper and a dump truck. And because I'm employing experienced people on a contract basis as needed, I can come away like now for months, and I don't have overhead of salary.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Salaried people and big equipment.
And it's a pretty good living?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, several times.
Yeah.
Guiding,
yeah,
of course.
What is it?
Well, you know, thinking of guides who have been down the Grand Canyon for decades, you know, at some point, either because of a relationship or their body, it's time for a transition to what they do next in life.
The smart ones.
Some of us stay down there for half a century and we're still there. So among river guides, there's this little saying that as you try to transition to another way of life, it's hard to row a desk.
Yeah, boy. There's some rivers in Australia. Have you done any rivers over there?
Well, it was back in the 80s when they were bringing me over to train the river guides, and then I'd do trips in New South Wales and Queensland and Tasmania.
What kind of rivers?
Small, rocky, technical, all paddle boats, no oars. Your oars would be up in rocks.
Yeah, they're small, rocky. But pretty much all over the place then you did.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of rivers, are there?
Well, it's the driest continent.
Yeah.
So the rivers are small. And I think they're flowing less than when I was doing that 40 years ago.
And we know possible reasons for that, don't we? Or yeah. We assume.
Yeah. So, the rivers are small, but exciting. And the Franklin River in Tasmania it's a real world-class river. You do a 10-day trip down it, and you're in there, and it feels way more remote than Grand Canyon.
Oh, that's cool. Now, did you get in the backcountry? Have you made it to Ayers Rock? Tell us a little bit about the continent, your travels around that. It's not a continent, I guess it is.
It is a continent.
Continent.
And one of seven. And
oh, that's right. That's right.
It's about the size of the 48 U.S. states.
Is it that big?
Yeah, yeah. It's big.
And I understand the outback is just like endless when you're driving across it on those dirt roads.
Yeah, I haven't driven all across it, but fly into the Red Center and then you can go to Ayers Rock or Uluru and other major rocks like that out in the center.
Now, the Australians, as a general rule, the ones I've met are a pretty robust, fun bunch. You must enjoy the people there.
Huh? Oh, yeah, it's great.
With your botany, do you incorporate with your guiding a lot of plant stuff, or are people drawn to your trips?
Yeah. I love teaching natural history, natural sciences on trips. And that's been a major focus of my Grand Canyon work over these five decades down there. In fact, a couple weeks, I go out leading a trip for 18 days with a group booked by the Grand Canyon Field Institute. And so we'll, a couple of us will be instructors, and we'll do a lot more talking than on most trips. A lot more interp.
Yeah.
We do it every April.
And that must be something you really look forward
to.
Oh,
it's great.
And that's with Outdoors Unlimited?
No, this is with Canyon Exploration.
Oh, I mean, excuse me, you're mostly doing...
Yeah, that's
Do you what, do any more with OU? Or
no,
it's, you're
I haven't
just on the Can-X
since
side.
The 80s.
Uh-huh. And then let's talk about a little bit of your tree ring work.
Well...
If that's not jumping ahead.
So much going on over these years. I was just a moment ago thinking about the high water 83 and all the stories to tell about that. But
well, let's go to that after we talk a little bit. Like, as I understand, you went back and got your PhD.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's kind of follow that line a little bit.
Well, in 1990, I started guiding on a lot of research trips, and we were river trips through Grand Canyon with oar-powered boats, you know, with Bob Webb and Jack Schmidt and Ted Mellis as some of the key scientists on those trips. And we're looking at changes in beaches resulting from Glen Canyon Dam having been built and finished in 63. And we were looking at changes in the tributary side canyon deltas caused by debris flows, which is kind of like a flash flood that's more like a concrete slurry coming down a side canyon.
Debris flows, yeah.
Yeah. So I was involved with a project replicating 100-year-old photographs taken by Stanton back in 1889. And we were getting our format cameras with lenses within inches of where his camera was 100 years before.
Yeah, I supported some of that when I had those logistics contracts all that same time.
Yeah. Yeah, we were
really cool.
A lot of us down there then. And so we were replicating these photos to see changes in the beaches and debris flows. And Stanton would often go up 50 feet above the river at a bend, take a shot upstream and downstream. And sometimes we would relocate that spot by the scenery, go up to occupy that site, you know, set up the tripod and the format camera, and in the foreground we would notice plants, and we would have these 8x10 prints of
the original
photos at very high resolution, and we would see plants like ephedra or Mormon tea, and somewhere in the foreground there's this plant. It's in the same place. It's coming out of ground by the same three little pebbles. And the branching is the same. And then when a realization comes over you that is really big, you kind of feel it like a little chill. And then you realize that is the same plant.
Yeah.
100 years later.
I remember that with several of those guys. I've kind of assisted on some of that stuff. And another interesting thing, didn't you guys figure out that the elevation of the camera, like maybe the guy was holding it in his lap compared to a tripod, or I remember something about adjusting, even though you had the right spot, the elevation off the ground took some figuring out, as I recall. Yeah.
The old photos were all taken off tripods, but there was kind of a short one involved.
Oh, I see. Is that what it was? Yeah. But isn't that remarkable? You think about say ephedra or whatever other bush, you're realizing that's the same plant.
Yes.
Was there much growth?
Well, looking at other photos from around the desert Southwest, in some places, for some other reason, people have gone to the same spot and taken a photograph at intervals over time.
Yeah.
So decades, you know, over a period of many decades or a century, some places there are many, many photographs. And plants like ephedra or blackbrush or such, it's the same plant 100 years later, but through this series of photos, you see that in wet decades, the plant is getting a little bigger. And in dry decades, the plant is getting a little smaller with dieback from the edge.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I didn't think about the fallback on that. Just the lack of resource. And then let's talk a little bit about your PhD. Where did you pursue that? Through which institution did you get your PhD?
The University of Arizona in Tucson. Oh. And it was a result of that Stanton Reef Photography Project that I kind of got invited down there to be a botanist for the U.S. Geological Survey, with, you know, my idea being concurrently going back to school after decades as a feral boatman. I went back to school for a PhD.
Good on you. That's impressive. And how long did that take you?
Oh, I was in Tucson 6 years, and some of my studies at the Tree Ring Lab, which is very famous and the first one worldwide, for using the study of...
Yeah, they're famous for that. Though.
...variation in the annual ring width of trees and how that can be used to date things and how it can be used to... learn things about climate and ecology.
A super accurate way, as it's turned out, isn't it? I mean, tree rings, dependent on the location and the species.
You know? To the exact year.
Yeah. I mean, that's they use it, and then you can overlap that data with other dating data and correlate a lot of the different aspects of the ecosystem, huh?
So one of the research projects that I was, you know, after my PhD, I was a research scientist on a project with NOAA and the University of Colorado Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research. And we went around collecting tree ring cores from places all around Colorado where we had precipitation records or stream flow records. So getting a geographic distribution and perspective on changes in stream flow and precipitation.
And that's interesting stuff.
So we had tree rings from three species and records going back often 1,000 years at a site. And you might have an instrumental record that's 100 years long. Well, you use that to create a transfer function whereby your master tree ring chronology for that site is used to predict precipitation. And you use half your instrumental record to create that mathematical transfer function, and then the other half to test it so you know how good it is. And then you use that relationship to look back at the 1,000 years before that.
And it really tightens up the accuracy, I bet, with those sorts of correlations. Huh?
And you get an idea that there were droughts like in the 1200s and 1500s that were severe. However, recently there's been a study that made a lot of media coverage using tree rings in the Rockies Mountains and the West, showing that the current 22-year drought in the American Southwest is more severe than what has occurred over the last 1,200 years of their tree ring record.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, that's an eye-opener for all of you people that are in denial. many of you that are listening, possibly in denial. Do you have to take the tree to count rings, or can you use plugs?
Oh, yeah. You use a core.
A core
from
sample,
from a healthy live tree. You twist this device, this handle, and this long hollow shaft goes into the tree. And when you remove it, you have a core sample.
Yeah. Like they do with ice and a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Every so often when you're in places, like I've noticed a few of them up here on the peaks with the bristle cone. There's some core samples I've seen on some species up there. Have you looked at any bristle cone?
I haven't done any bristle cone work, but I worked on pinyon pine and ponderosa pine and Douglas fir around the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah,
for that project I mentioned.
I think there's some stuff like over at the university here, bristle cone, tree ring stuff. That's fascinating to me, how that could really open your eyes as far as the climate of past projection. Now is what kind, how do they put those models together to predict the weather? Are they very accurate or?
It's easier to predict climate than weather.
Yeah.
It's easier to use all the information we have to predict climatic patterns over, you know, longer periods of time than the weather 2 weeks from now.
Like, yeah, exactly. That makes complete sense there. And so talk about what you're doing in Australia in regards to, are you still really involved with the botany of Australia? What kind of stuff other than eucalyptus trees is over there? Is it a pretty diverse, it's got to be an interesting change for you.
Oh, the plant diversity is really high, and the vegetation is so different. The families of plants in the southern hemisphere are, it's like a different collection of families of plants.
Yeah, I bet it's pretty neat for you.
When you look at plants in the northern hemisphere, and especially the farther north you go and the farther up mountains you go, you find more similarity between the floras of North America and Europe and you're on into Eurasia.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's called the holistic or whole Arctic flora. All around
the northern hemisphere,
the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere, there's a lot of relationships of plants, and also around the southern hemisphere of different set of families, because a lot of those continental masses were once connected down in the southern hemisphere.
That is pretty interesting. And what are the most striking things that you see the southern hemisphere have that's void in the northern hemisphere? I mean, just to throwing that out there.
Oh, lots of plants in the family that eucalyptus is in, Myrtaceae,
mm-hmm.
and lots of plants in Proteaceae, and then Araucarius, the monkey puzzle trees. There are species that are native to all around the world, South America, South Africa, Australia, and the Pacific Islands, that are all in this genus Araucaria, the big monkey puzzle tree,
mm-hmm.
and they're a little different to cut down.
And why do you say that, or what is the?
Some of them are really spiky and pokey, I end up doing tree removals of all different kinds of trees.
Oh yeah, everything's got a sharp spot on it.
Well, in people's yards, over houses, if a tree is getting old or weakening in certain ways, then people come first over trees, and every kind of tree over there is a different challenge for taking it down. And it's kind of an irony. Here I am, the tree lover and tree hugger, and my job over there is to
murder them.
Yeah, that's right.
Slowly take them apart.
But they grow faster than you can cut them down.
Do they grow pretty fast, eucalyptus?
I've taken down 100-foot trees that the homeowner had planted 30 years before.
That's pretty good. That is pretty good. With all your travels, and I try and ask, especially you world travelers, what they're seeing in their 50 years as far as the overall, not just global warming, not those type changes, but the human growth and the human footprint and the human aspect of what you've seen and where you've seen it. Like when you're in the Himalayas, are you seeing a real, like, 10 years later, are you seeing growth or
in some places?
In some places that are more are the villages growing?
In some places, yes. Some, no. Some places, they're moving out of the high mountain, hard life down to the cities.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense.
But worldwide, the human population has really been increasing. And the impact on natural vegetation and natural aquatic systems, freshwater and marine, has been growing and growing. And the land use change, reducing habitat for native species, that's
phenomenal.
That's as big an impact by humans as our impacts on climate. And so humans are quite likely driving the sixth major extinction event in the history of life on Earth, You know, we're talking about billions of years. And here we are driving it.
The devegetation thing is so much bigger deal than people realize, too, as far as our atmospheric condition, right? I mean, the deforestation all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a bit of that in the Himalayan region, hasn't there? I mean, haven't they burnt a lot of the wood there just as far as human
use? Yes, there's been a lot of conversion of forest there, and probably one of the biggest places in the world is the tropical rainforest, especially like the Amazon. Large parts of the Amazon are being converted to grassland, and sometimes intentionally to create pasture for that tropical beef.
And then accelerate that with methane.
Oh, yeah. Well,
from the beef.
So in our lifetimes, a lot of the Amazon tropical rainforest will end up converted to grassland. And it's thought that it will likely stay that way for at least thousands of years. So humans are making a big impact.
Well, they sure are. And do you have any optimism of us curbing that at all? Or is it like a runaway train, Gary?
Both. We're making big strides in alternate energy and thinking about... like the Glasgow conference, but I don't want to get into the politics of it here, but just think more about the biology. We're making big changes, and a lot of people are really worried, you know, for good reason, because the world's changing. But in a broad perspective of life on Earth, I think life on Earth is kind of like water. After a big disruption, water always finds a new path and finds a new level.
Yeah.
And it'll be different, and some aspects of it we won't like as much as the way it was before. But, you know, life goes on.
That's a really interesting insight. The Earth does seem to have a way of re-cleansing, but... what really strikes me is the fact that there were dinosaurs that got wiped out by an astrological event, right?
Mm-hmm. Astronomical, both.
But the extinction part of it, I guess, is part of the cycle of the planet, and we are just a biological element. But in the other extinctions, was a single species involved in accelerating that extinction?
Oh, I don't think so.
The first
time. Yeah, this is the first time that one species...
So you humans, be proud of yourselves. You had your voice. You had your voice. Well, we're kind of running out of time. I'd love to sit down with you again. I mean, you've got a lot to share with all of us. And it's great that everybody came in and got to know Gary along with these stories that I'm getting in here. And, you know, it always goes back to get out there and enjoy what wilderness and outdoors has to offer and, you know, take care of it. And if you have any ideas on how to slow down the demise of our wilderness, get involved. Let us know, too, or let's get you on the show if you have some good ideas.
Right.
But, Gary, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been great.
Well, this is The Big Adventure with Gary Bolton and Brian Durker. And, you know, I always say keep it right side up, you guys. Get your booster shots. I think I'm ready for another booster. I just feel like it. You know, just get the boosters. I think we are knocking this thing back a little bit. But I really, if you are against the shots, go ahead and get one anyway. But like I say, keep it right side up and love your neighbor. This is Gary Bolton and Brian Durker out on Big Adventures.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.